Well, welcome back. Great to see you all. We are, as you know, continuing our studies of the historical context of the New Testament, and we are just reaching that moment where Rome, which had been a republic, becomes Rome the Empire. So that's the kind of snapshot we are at. Last week we were looking at the collision that took place, in a sense, between Rome and its gradual eastward expansion. And of course, Pompey was leading this eastern campaign, as it was called, really rewriting the map of the east. And in 63, his campaign brought him to the doorstep of Jerusalem, you recall. And it was there that he made a deal with John Hyrcanus II, who had Jerusalem under siege, trying to take back control of that city. And in the conversations they had, John Hyrcanus agreed to help Rome if Rome would put him back as the high priest. Pompey was not willing to put him in as a king. At this point, Rome wanted to make sure its political authority was not challenged or otherwise undermined, but he did willingly put John Hyrcanus in as priest, and that made him in some ways the most powerful man in Jerusalem outside of Roman control. And that's where we left it. So we want to pick up right there and continue our conversation this morning. I hope by the end of our discussion today we will have at least summarized to some degree the career of Augustus Caesar. You'll recall that Augustus Caesar was the Caesar who was ruling at the moment that Christ was born. He's mentioned one time in the New Testament, and that's the familiar Christmas text that we're going to look at right now. So if you have your Bible and would like to turn to Luke chapter 2, that's the one and only time that Augustus Caesar is actually mentioned by name. He's alluded to on other occasions, but this is the one time we hear him mentioned. And while I'm thinking about it, just a little reminder, next week, no class. Next week is our stewardship altogether Sunday. So be sure to be here, but don't come expecting this class. And then 2 weeks out, we'll be back and continuing from there. So this is the text that we usually only read around Christmas time. But hey, Christmas is only, what is it, how many shopping days now? So this will kind of get you in the mood, you know, thinking about it. Luke chapter 2, beginning at verse 1, the Word of God. In those days, a decree went out from Emperor, the Greek is Kaiser or Caesar, Augustus, that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration and was taken when Quirinius was governor of Syria. All went to their own towns to be registered. Joseph also went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to the city of David called Bethlehem, because he was descended from the house and family of David. He went to be registered with Mary, to whom he was engaged and who was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for her to deliver her child. She gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in bands of cloth and laid him in a feed trough because there was no place for them in the inn. The greatest single event in the history of the human race thus far, the incarnation of Christ, and I doubt that Augustus Caesar ever heard of it. But interestingly enough, the reason we're interested in Augustus is because the greatest event took place under his watch. And so he's getting way more attention than he might have otherwise just because of this incident that occurred around the year 4 BC when Christ was born. So let's have a word of prayer and we'll get underway. Father, we're grateful to you for your continual mercies to us. We thank you for a new day, for a fresh beginning. We thank you for the opportunity we have on this particular day of the week to gather with your people. We thank you for freedom of worship. We thank you for the message of the gospel, which has changed our lives. We pray that our investigation of the historical events that surrounded the birth of Christ this morning would be guided by your Spirit, and that all of these things would be to the honor of Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. Alrighty. Well, this is that moment, what I'm calling the transformation of Rome. We sort of have been alluding to this all along, but now we get to this moment when really, officially and technically, Rome ceases to be a republic and becomes an empire. So it's the third chapter of our consideration of Roman history. We've had the Kingdom of Rome, we've had the Republic of Rome, and now we're going to have Imperial Rome, the Empire of Rome. That's the name that I'm giving to this, the transformation of Rome. Two men dominate the story. One is Gnaeus Pompey, and the other is Julius Caesar. We alluded last week to Pompey. I want to give you a little bit more on him and a little bit of detail on Julius Caesar, but our real focus, as I say, is hopefully going to be to get to Augustus, although there's so much interesting history here, I'm going to have to discipline myself to keep moving. So just, you know, keep a big hook in back that threatens to yank me off the stage if I don't keep going. Here's the two guys, both of them pretty good looking. Well, you know, Pompey returned from the east in 62. Now, if you're keeping track of the chronology, it was 63 that he arrived at Jerusalem. And in 63, Rome officially occupied Jerusalem. Pompey visited the temple. All of that we covered last week. He completed what was called the Eastern Settlement. The East had more or less been up for grabs for some time, ever since the Hellenistic powers had been vying for various pieces of real estate and so on. Pompey comes through and rewrites the map of the East, including the map of Israel and the surrounding countries, Syria, Egypt, and so on. And that came to be called Pompey's Eastern Settlement. So hang on to that term. He goes back to Rome in 62 and celebrates a great triumph. As you know, the word triumph is used to describe a party, really, in which a conquering hero returns to his hometown. All the people come out and give him a big hullabaloo, a big recognition. He delivers gifts to people and so on. It's quite the event. And so Pompey came back as a conquering hero and was very much welcomed by his people in that regard. That, by the way, is the term that stands behind the notion of the triumphal entry. When Christ entered Jerusalem, it was a triumph. That's the kind of celebration that was going on. The only unexpected aspect of it was that Christ hadn't fought the battle yet. Usually, the conquering hero has won the battle and is returning home. He was going home to fight the battle. That was the irony of Christ and his triumph, but we'll leave that for another time. Pompey comes back. He is, even though he's very, very popular at the level of the people of Rome, he's viewed with a high degree of suspicion by the Senate. The Senate, ever since Marius and Sulla, had been concerned about these guys who go out with a military establishment and basically get a lot of power going for them, and it seems to be power that will threaten, ultimately, the Senate itself and its prestige. And so even though Pompey was popular, he nevertheless had this tense relationship going on with the Senate at this moment. And that's part of what leads to the story as it unfolds here. Julius Caesar was a man very well known and popular in the Senate, but he had higher aspirations. And so he floated a proposition to Pompey and to one other man whose name was Crassus. And the proposition was, let's the three of us form a kind of triangle of power. And it came to be called the first triumvirate, in which these three men, in a sort of mutual agreement to help each other, became the most powerful single kind of established united front in Rome, in the Roman world. And Caesar was a very smart guy, and he was more or less angling to accomplish this. And so he makes this proposition to Pompey, and that becomes a kind of game changer in the history of Rome. So the three people that formed this triumvirate were, first of all, Julius Caesar. Now, I just want to go through this fairly rapidly. If you're trying to take notes, then I suggest you just put down your pen and listen, you know. There will be stuff to take notes on later, but this, unless you need to get a life, you really don't need this. But I want to give you some idea where Julius Caesar came from. So quickly we'll go through this. He was born in 106 to a family which was aligned with Marius. So last week we talked about Marius and Sulla, that whole thing. Well, his family was sort of a middle-class family, the equestrian class within Rome, but they were aligned with Marius and against Sulla. So it meant his family, from the very beginning, was politically engaged and involved. Caesar himself was trained as an attorney, and in his early years, his 20s and his early 30s, he was basically a prosecutor. And what he did was largely prosecute corrupt politicians in Rome, especially after the death of Sulla, which was in 79. So that's where he kind of got a name for himself. There's some interesting anecdotes concerning Caesar. I think one of the most interesting was he went off to go to a school of rhetoric on the island of Sicily, and on the trip he was captured by pirates in the Mediterranean. This was not uncommon, and they would hold these guys for ransom. And so they were holding Julius Caesar, and he was such a personality, he would joke with these guys. He said, "How much are you trying to get for me?" And they'd say, "It's so much." He said, "That's not nearly enough. You know, you'd be asking for a lot more." And then he'd joke with them tongue-in-cheek, "You know, when I get back, I'm going to come back and crucify all you guys." Well, in 73, he made good on that. That was no joke. But Julius Caesar was the kind of guy who just had a personality on steroids. You know, he was just an amazing guy. And he did, however, have a mean streak in him. And on this occasion, he made good on that little promise to those particular pirates. He came back about 2 years later, and that was what happened to them. When Pompey returned, Caesar was strongly supporting him. Even though Pompey was becoming somewhat a suspicious character from the Senate's point of view, Caesar was a stalwart supporter, a kind of cheerleader for Pompey within the Senate. And I think already Caesar saw something of the prospects of his own future. That's part of the reason he wanted to support Pompey at that point. He was elected what's called Pontifex Maximus in 63. That would be really the highest religious character in Rome. And so Caesar throughout his career was able to, along with his other claims to sort of credibility, was able to make this claim as well, that he had this kind of religious office that he carried with him along the way. He was brilliant in his military achievements. Between 62 and 60, he was off in Spain and made pretty effective work of the project there, bringing the entire Iberian Peninsula under Roman control. So now we have Rome both extending way off to the east, as far as Jerusalem, but as far west as you could practically go without getting to Central America. You know, he's in Spain there, and that's pretty much the entire Mediterranean now has become a Roman lake, and it's all connected to that, and that largely is the efforts of Caesar. In 59, he wanted to be elected as a consul for the year 59, but he knew he would need help to pull it off. The politics in Rome were dicey enough and corrupt enough that he needed some help, and so he wanted to pull together this so-called first triumvirate, and he floated this idea to Pompey that Pompey would hopefully jump in and help him with this. The next guy that was part of the triumvirate was Marcus Licinius Crassus. He'd been a military lieutenant under Sulla with Pompey. The two of them served as peers under Sulla, but when Sulla died, Pompey and Crassus became intense rivals. But Pompey always seemed to be a step ahead. And so that meant that in some ways Crassus was always coming up just a little bit short. His one great achievement was he defeated Spartacus in the great slave uprising that took place in 71. He was elected consul with Pompey in the year 70, but he then wanted to have a military commission. He never got it for 5 years. That's what he wanted for 5 years. The Senate refused to give it to him, partly because of their own reservations about giving people too much political authority. When Pompey was returning from Jerusalem, from the east, Crassus was so worried about the rivalry they had had earlier that he actually fled from Rome with his family, fearing that Pompey might use his new power to squash Crassus once and for all, because they had been political enemies. Caesar once again steps in. He's a great kind of, fence mender and mediator. And he brings Crassus in. So Crassus and Pompey, who had been enemies are somehow brought together now with Caesar's help, and they form this first triumvirate, which was really so important in the developing, changing Roman world. The third guy was Pompey himself. We've already looked at him. Brilliant military career. He returns to Rome flush from these victories over Mithridates, the great king of the East, who he conquered before he got to Jerusalem. That was in about 64. He came back, he had this great celebration. He wanted to run for consul, but a technical point in Roman law prevented him from doing so, and the Senate was firm and entrenched. He was not going to run for consul, given that he already had this great military achievement in his back pocket. So the Senate was resisting him, and that was part of the awkward moment that was created now at this time. The senators basically resisted the Eastern settlement, resisted Pompey, gave him some grief, and so he agrees to this first triumvirate. And so I've tried to give you a real quick sketch how these guys came together, but here, this is who they are. Caesar is the one who more or less engineers this thing. The terms of the first triumvirate were, first of all, that Crassus and Pompey would support Caesar to be a consul for the year 59. And so they did that. Caesar would assure Pompey's eastern settlement, which would be a huge and important prestige factor for Pompey. If he had done all that work in the East and not gotten his settlement of the East to be accepted, that would have been a huge embarrassment to him and a loss of face. And so Caesar promised that as consul, he would make sure that Pompey's eastern settlement was approved and that everything necessary would be achieved that way. Caesar sweetened the pot slightly by offering his young and beautiful daughter, Julia, who was about 19 years old, to be Pompey's wife. He was about 40 years older than she was. You might think she wouldn't be really up for this deal, you know, but she was. And as near as we can tell from all sources that seem to be reliable, the two of them were very, very much in love for their fairly short-lived marriage. But it was at least for a few years, just a wonderful source of joy for Pompey and apparently for Julia as well. And it did cement the relationship between Pompey and Julius Caesar, at least for a while, because they could have had some competing interests themselves, but that did seem to overcome any problems along those lines. Crassus would be provided with a military commission, something he'd wanted all these years, and he was going to go out into the East and sort of continue what Pompey had begun. So that's the deal. There's the first triumvirate. That all goes into effect in about the year 160. All right. Julius Caesar now, having served 1 year as consul, goes and fights the Gallic Wars. You know that Gaul is the ancient name for France. France got its name from the Frankish tribes that came down under Clovis many centuries later. But before then, it was called Gaul. So Paul's letter to the Galatians was a letter to people who were living, in some sense, in connection with Gaul. Not really the land of Gaul, but a Roman province that went by that name. So the Roman world has expanded to the east and to the west. The one part of the world that hasn't been yet invaded by Rome is the north. And Gaul was due north of Italy. Now, the only part of Gaul that was controlled by Rome was called the Transalpine. And if you can read that map, I don't know how, yeah, you can see it right there. The Transalpine Gaul, right here at the bottom, is the only part. It was the Alps. And so Caesar was given a military commission, or a governorship, really, of Gaul, but it was just that little strip. But of course, his plan was to take all of Gaul and bring it within the Roman fold. And so this gave rise to what are called the Gallic Wars. And the Gallic Wars lasted for about 10 years, and Caesar was the brilliant military tactician and engineer who was able, over about a 10-year period, to essentially extend Roman control into that region. At one point, he actually made a little incursion across the English Channel into Britain. He saw all these people with painted faces looking kind of like, who's the actor? William Wallace. Mel Gibson in that movie, remember that? And he looked at them and he applied to them the Latin word for painted, Brit, and thus Britain came to be the term that was applied to that particular part of the world. And so, but Caesar didn't stay. He thought, this place is too scary, you know. So he went home, and he went back and basically completed his labors there in the Gallic conflict. All those arrows are just talking about major battles he fought. I won't go through all of those details, but there it is. Caesar was not only a bright military guy and engineer, but he was a very good PR man. And so as he was engaged in these adventures, defeating various chieftains, most notable of which was Vercingetorix, who sort of drew together all of these Gallic tribes, he wrote little sort of short stories describing some of these exploits, and he sent them back to Rome where they were published. And so it was like a little journal that would come out about every other month or so describing Caesar's latest victories. That was later compiled and came to be called a book by the title The Gallic Wars. And you can go down today to Barnes & Noble and buy your very own copy. And it is wonderful reading, and you really begin to realize what a master storyteller and personal promoter Caesar was. He knew how to do it all, and he was very good at it. All right, so what happens? Well, he greatly expands Roman holdings during these years into Europe, into this region that we would call France. The first triumvirate itself remained intact, in good shape for that first 5 years. They re-upped in 54 for another 5-year extension of the terms of the first triumvirate. It included the election of Pompey as a consul once again, and it included Crassus being involved, further involved in his military achievements, but it all kind of came crashing down in 53. In 53, Julia died. This beautiful daughter of Julius Caesar died in childbirth, and it broke the heart and almost the mind of Pompey. He was, by every account, very much in love with his wife, and she with him, and the loss was devastating to him, not to mention to Julius Caesar himself. And even though they shared that common denominator between them of Julia, her absence immediately began to introduce a fault line between the two of them that would ultimately consummate in the civil war in Rome. The other thing that happened in 53 was Crassus, who was out fighting his wars in Parthia, which is east of Jerusalem, you know, more in Mesopotamia, beyond Mesopotamia, really, he died. And so the first triumvirate in 53 is fini. And that does change things considerably. Pompey drifted steadily toward the Senate. The Senate was now worried more about Caesar than it had ever been worried about Pompey, you see. Because now Caesar was becoming more popular than any military character in Roman history. And the Senate saw the handwriting on the wall. They saw that this guy was getting enough independent power that it could very well challenge senatorial authority right at its heart. And they needed a champion. And the most available champion they could think of was Pompey, the very guy they used to worry about, you know. But now he is drifting away from Caesar and drifting toward the Senate, and this is beginning to set up what will eventually become the Civil War. The Senate and Pompey viewed Caesar with increasing alarm, and so they laid out, and Pompey himself issued this to Caesar, that he was required to come to Rome, and he had to do two things. He had to come without his military, and he had to relinquish his commission as governor of the Transalpine and all of Gaul before he came. Caesar knew that that would be political suicide. He had immunity from prosecution as long as he had an official office in the Roman world. But if he relinquished his commission, if he relinquished his generalship, then he would immediately be paralyzed in all kinds of lawsuits and litigation and stuff, and essentially neutralized, and so he didn't want to do that. He could stay home, but he wanted to capitalize on all the things he'd accomplished. He wanted to go to Rome, but he didn't want to relinquish all of his powers in the process, and so in a very famous moment, he crossed the Rubicon. And you know that expression, the Rubicon River is a little... It's not a vehicle, by the way, made by... Who makes the Rubicon? Is that Chevy? Who makes that? Is it Jeep? All right. It is actually a great vehicle if it's made by Jeep, so I'll... But anyway, the Rubicon itself is a little tiny river to the north of Rome at the upper part of Italy, as you can see there. There's nothing much to it. You could wade across it. It was like a stream. But it happened to demarcate the northern border of official Rome. You see, outside of that, you had a Roman province. Inside of it, you were really in Rome proper. And so Julius Caesar was, as the story goes, standing there really on his horse at the edge of the Rubicon. You know, what was he going to do? Was he going to cross the Rubicon, which would basically amount to a declaration of war? Or would he stay on the side and kind of forfeit all of the benefits he'd gotten by his achievements? What was he going to do? And so he, and these are the famous words that he said as he crossed it, the die is cast. And that's where that little expression has become colloquial. The die is cast. He crossed the Rubicon, not with his entire army, but with one legion, 6,000 men, a very small and modest group. He wanted to make it clear he wasn't coming to make war on anybody, but he wasn't willing politically to simply submit to the senatorial demands. And so he's trying to slice it as thin as possible, cross the Rubicon, which is an illegal act, but not as a great display of sort of showmanship here or military threat or any such thing. So anyway, that's what he does. Nevertheless, the moment he did it, the Senate panicked. Pompey panicked. They had heard he was coming with his whole army and was, you know, loaded for bear, that he was going to come and attack Rome, as had happened earlier under Sulla. And so these people, without getting further information, just fled. Pompey himself wanted to fight Caesar, but not here, not now. He wanted to regroup a little bit more. And so Pompey and the Senate all fled south. Caesar came down from the Rubicon to Rome, welcomed all along the way by all the people of Italy as the most famous and most popular man probably in the history of Rome, the whole Roman world itself. Everywhere, crowds were cheering him and giving him the most wonderful expressions of praise. He entered into Rome, of course, unopposed, and was able to essentially occupy the city as his own. He was astonished when he got there to find that the Senate had left in such panic that they had left the huge treasury in the temple in Rome. And of course, as the Pontifex Maximus, he had perfect legitimate authority to take that treasury and give it to all his men. And so they were very happy to have come along with him, and it turned out to be a very profitable venture for them without even having to drop shed a drop of blood along the way. Caesar then, much to his grief, fights three battles with Pompey, all the time hoping he can just sit down and talk to the man. But Pompey, now well within the control of the Senate, fights three battles, loses every one of them, although sometimes just barely, but Caesar was the better tactician. And so Pompey eventually decides, because he's now been crippled militarily by these losses, to flee to Egypt. And so he goes to Egypt because Egypt is an ally. Remember, they've been an ally ever since the Maccabean Revolt. Egypt has been under Roman control, and Pompey feels he can go there to find safe harbor, retool his defenses, and maybe fight another day. He shows up in Egypt, but unfortunately, Ptolemy the 13th, the last of the Ptolemies, was reading the tea leaves and figured out that Caesar was more likely to come out on top. Thinking he was doing Caesar a favor, he double-crossed Pompey, had him assassinated, cut off his head, and gave the head of Pompey to Julius Caesar in a basket. Ptolemy thought, Julius Caesar is going to love me. The fact of the matter is, Julius Caesar was outraged in the extreme. He wanted to sit down with Pompey. This was his former son-in-law. He loved the man. I think he genuinely loved him, and he wanted him as an ally, and he thought, if we can just cut past all of this, you know, battles and stuff and sit down and have a Starbucks, I can get this man back on my side. And that was what Julius Caesar wanted to do, and he was apoplectic when he learned that, you know, Ptolemy had done this. So he immediately deposed Ptolemy the 13th. He didn't have him killed, but that was the end of his career, leaving a bit of a vacuum in Egyptian rule. And amazingly enough, that's when Elizabeth Taylor showed up. It was just, you know, one of those things. But if you ever saw that movie with Richard Burton and all those people, a wonderful movie about Cleopatra, you know there's a scene where she is smuggled into the presence of Julius Caesar in a kind of a Persian rug. Remember that? They roll it out and she comes rolling out of this Persian rug. That happened. She had been sort of exiled by Ptolemy the 13th. She didn't know what Julius Caesar was going to do exactly. She was very, very bright. And so she has herself smuggled into the presence of Julius Caesar in this Persian rug as a gift. You know, they unroll it, and out comes rolling Cleopatra. Many people don't appreciate Cleopatra. She is one of the great minds of all of ancient history. She was never reputed to be a great beauty, but she knew how to play her advantages, and she did it in a remarkable way. She was fluent in 7 languages. She was definitely a student of history. She knew all of, you know, political and military history and so on. She was clearly a genius politically, and she was, you know, always kind of playing her options in the way that was most effective. And she was, of course, not above playing her feminine options as well, which is exactly what she did here. But she was a force to be reckoned with either way. So she and, of course, Julius Caesar come to have a relationship. He installs her as the pharaoh, the last pharaoh of Egypt. They have a relationship that produces a child, Caesarion, who's born about 2 years later. And so Cleopatra then becomes the ruler of Egypt in the absence of her brother, Ptolemy the 13th. Caesar continued his campaigns for another couple of years, defeating the last pockets of senatorial resistance to his rule. And finally, in 45, he returns to Rome. A last little conspiracy among the senators, hoping to reinstate the Republic, wants to eliminate Caesar. And as you know, on the Ides of March in 44 BC, Julius Caesar is assassinated out in the Roman Forum there. And so that's the end of the career of Julius Caesar. But everything had changed with this man and his career. It was an entirely new game in Rome. And this brings now the next character, the true heir to Caesar, the adopted son of Caesar, to the throne, and his name was Octavian. He's better known to us as Augustus Caesar, but of course he was at this time, at the death of Caesar, 18 years old, and the name that he had was Octavian. He is, I think by everybody's accounts, the greatest Caesar of all of Roman history. Caesar, as you know, is a family name. Julius Caesar, like that was his last name, but it became not just a name, but a title. It sort of morphed into a title over time, but Octavian could properly call himself Octavian Caesar because he was adopted. He was the nephew of Julius and was adopted and made to be his legal son at that point. Augustus Caesar was able to do something so adroitly that I think to this day we have to stand in a sort of awe at his ability. He did preserve the outward republic as window dressing. He didn't have to do that. He was far and away the most powerful man. The support that he had across the board as the heir to Julius Caesar gave him eventually just unquestioned power. But he always did it with a very soft touch. And what he wanted to do was preserve the feel of a republican Rome. At the same time, he ruled it with a bit of an iron fist from inside, but he had the so-called velvet glove. You know, he always did it with a fair amount of finesse. Augustus Caesar is the man most closely associated with this remarkable idea that's called the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. And I always think when I hear that expression of Paul's comment to the Galatians, when he says in Galatians chapter 3 that Christ in the fullness of time, the pleroma to kairo, the fullness of the time, and it's a very rich Greek word or phrase that Paul uses there, meaning that everything in a sense had come together for this moment. And what's astonishing to me is that even though Augustus Caesar was such a powerful character, you have to say from the point of view of a biblical perspective that he was only doing God's bidding and that God had indeed intended that there would be this great Pax Romana and that there would be this fullness of time and that there would be all of the astonishing benefits that would accrue to the Roman world by virtue of this genius, just so that when Christ was born, with the least possible impediment, that gospel would be spread throughout the world in the most rapid possible conceivable way, you see. And so the Pax Romana should be quite important to us as Christians just because it had that very significant role to play in our own history as the Christian faith. The family of Augustus Caesar, he was born the son of Octavius, who was governor in Macedon. Octavius, the father, died in 58 when Octavian was only 4 years old. And so he grew up largely without a father. His mother, Attia, was a niece to Julius Caesar. So actually, Octavian was the great-nephew, you might say, of Julius Caesar. But he was adopted when Julius was 2 years out from his death. You know, he didn't know, of course, he was going to die in 2 years. But he adopted Octavian in 46, and that became his oldest son, therefore, and his only son. Caesarion, who was born to Cleopatra, died early on, and so this was really the only heir that was in line then to take the throne, or take at least to inherit, let's say, the benefits won by Julius Caesar. When word reached Octavian, who was in Macedon, of the death of his uncle, aka father, he immediately marshals the military forces that are with him. He was already at 18, a military commander, goes back to Rome, and lays the city under siege, hoping to smoke out the conspirators who are responsible for the assassination of Julius Caesar. While there, he forms the second triumvirate, a three-way alliance with two other men. One was named Mark Antony, who was the chief lieutenant, you might say, under Julius Caesar. The other was a man named Marcus Lepidus. They were able to invade, drive out these assassins of Caesar. They chased them down to the city of Philippi, and the Battle of Philippi took place in 42, where they both die. And then the three of them, this second triumvirate, split up Rome into three big slices of pie. Octavian rules in the middle, the Italian peninsula. Lepidus rules Spain and northern Africa. And Mark Antony rules in the east, including Egypt, where, of course, Cleopatra is presently occupying the throne. In the year 36, Lepidus, who had already had a long career, decides he's not up for this ongoing kind of political conflict. He retires under some degree of pressure, and that's the end of the triumvirate, and it results now in a two-way division of the Roman world. And so for about 4 years, we have this two-way rule. But again, there's, you know, two kings doesn't make a lot of sense. And it seems that Mark Antony is increasingly being taken under the spell, if you will, of Cleopatra. At least that's the way it looks from the Roman point of view, which finally seems to legitimize a declaration of war, so that in 32, you have this second civil war that takes place, in which Octavian launches a battle on Mark Antony. The most famous conflict that took place was the Battle of Actium. That was in 31. As a result of that, Octavian won, and Cleopatra and her lover, Mark Antony, commit suicide and die, and that whole story that you remember from the movies. And that's the end, then, of this divided empire, and it puts Octavian in the role of the ruler of Rome. I'm sorry to rush through this so rapidly, but I want to get back to my Sunday school lesson, so let me just give this to you quickly. Octavian has a wonderful dance that he performs with the Senate. He wants to give them as much prestige, as much recognition, as much respect as he can, while at the same time not giving them any authority that would actually undermine his own position. But he does several things that are pure genius. He disbands the armies, his own position as a military commander. He disbands his army, I should say. He lets himself be elected consul, which would be a legitimate political office to hold at that point. He returns power, at least ostensibly, to the Senate. He reinstates them as the great august body of the Roman Republic. He wants to do everything he can to create a facade of Republican Rome, while at the same time he is the true powerhouse in the middle. The Senate had been so embattled for so long, they were overwhelmed with gratefulness. Augustus knew they would be. And they confer on him all kinds of additional powers. They make him more powerful than he'd been in the first place, you see. And they confer on him all kinds of great prestige, including the title Augustus, which means August One, one worthy of being worshipped. And so the Senate actually gives back to Augustus Caesar now more than he had risked, put at risk when he was kind of making these moves. So it was quite a remarkable turn of events. And so the term Augustus is what we know him by, Augustus Caesar. This is Octavian. What did he do? He reformed Rome's finances, its tax system. He made it much more equitable. He created a permanent army to secure the borders. There were no wars. Virtually no military conflict during his rule. He was so astute in really securing Rome, even though it was had vast holdings. He brought stability, predictability, and equity to the Roman world. He did all of these things really at a time that had been highly tumultuous. He sort of restores a sense of steady currency and of a predictable kind of political process. He famously said, "I found Rome brick, I left it marble." That's not just poetry. He really did something along those lines. He transformed the roads, the trade, the mail, the transport, all of which had a huge positive effect for the Christian message when the Christian message started hitting the street just shortly after his reign was over. He created Rome's first police force, Rome's first fire departments. The one thing he failed at, he tried his best to elevate the moral character of the Roman people. Even by the time of Augustus, the sexual license that was already spreading freely through the society alarmed him. He was a man of marital faithfulness himself, and he tried to both model and as much as possible advocate for a high moral standard, for marital fidelity. It's astonishing to see how hard he worked. He failed at it. It's a great tribute to total depravity. You just can't, you know, legislate people into morality. And so that was the one point where he was himself quite disappointed, but nevertheless, he did give it a good try. Where I'm going to leave our discussion is Augustus and Herod. So next 2 weeks out, we will return and pick up the story of Augustus, especially considering Herod. You know that Herod the Great and his six successors who become the Herods that you run into in the New Testament can be a little bit confusing. Who are these guys? What's their connection to that family? And so next time I'd like to really deal with the Herods separately, and that'll at least start in connection with Augustus. Okay, let's come back to this text in Luke and the 30 seconds I have left here. My Sunday school lesson for you this morning. 3 points from this text that we read. This, if you got here a little late, it was in Luke chapter 2. 3 little points to note. Number one, in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus, that all the world should be registered. Whatever else you get out of our lesson this morning, let's at least be clear about this. Augustus Caesar is not someone on the order of Uncle Remus, you know, or Brer Rabbit. He is a real historical character, and the entire flavor of the New Testament is to say to us that God works in history. Now, I know that with you, I probably don't have to beat this drum too loud or too long, but there are, as you know, plenty of Christian people out there who bifurcate faith from life. They have a kind of mystical approach to the Christian faith that is lovely in a sort of strange place, but then there's life on the street, business is business, you got to get along, you got to do what you got to do, and somehow there's a wall that separates faith from life, you know, faith from history. As Christian people, that's not the way we see it. We believe God is working in history, and that the very details of history, including a character like Augustus Caesar, is actually doing God's bidding. And if that's true in the first century, it's true in the 21st century. And so God is still very much running this universe. Christ is still on his throne. And the things that are happening in life, whoever's elected president, whatever may take place, you see, in the immediate circumstances of our lives, are still under the supervision and authority of the one who said, "All authority is given unto me in heaven and on earth." That's point one. Point two, notice this little remark. Augustus Caesar said, he issued a decree that all the world should be registered. That was a Roman census. The census started way back with that king. Remember that guy, Tullius Hostilius? He was the first one to put in place a census. And it became one of the central features of Roman life that they would have a census ever so often, and by that means there were privileges that were doled out and responsibilities that were imposed. It was one of the most important central ordering features of Roman life, but I'll tell you, for a lot of people, it was a plain nuisance. A couple that come to mind, Joseph and Mary. Here she is deep into a pregnancy, and all of a sudden, oh, you've got to be kidding, census. Of all the lousy timing. And so here is this poor woman who's got to be loaded on a donkey and go this long and not very pleasant trip from Galilee around the outside of Samaria, remember all that, to make it to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem, so they can sign their names on a census form. Now, I don't know if you ever had the experience of feeling like government is just a pain in the beep, you know what I'm saying? You ever had the feeling that if there's one more little loose end, one more little curveball that government throws to you, one more little line to fill out, form to sign, this or that, that you're just going to, you know, explode? Please be aware that even when we are dealing with those kinds of nuisances, that not only governmental, whatever it may be, you know, that all of these things are also within God's province. God put in place a census that would bring Joseph and Mary to the city where Christ must be born. Augustus Caesar didn't know that. He wasn't reading Micah in the Old Testament. Oh, good heavens, these people have to get to Beth. He didn't know. He was doing blindly, precisely what God was calling him to do. And the next time you're troubled by some IRS form you've got to fill out, just keep in mind, that form came straight from heaven itself. I know, it galls me to say that, but, you know, that's the way they felt about it. The last little point comes down to verse 4. Joseph also went to the town of Nazareth in Galilee, the city of David, because he was descended from the house and family of David. Joseph was descended from the family of David, as was Mary, as we hear in other contexts. That means these two people, Joseph and Mary, by a proper reckoning of Jewish society, were nobility. They were a prince and a princess of the royal family. They should have dressed in nice clothing. They should have had all the privileges that appertain to being nobility in a civilization. They should have been the upper crust. They had been marginalized. They had been pushed aside. They had been neglected by their own civilization, and essentially a usurping family, the Hasmoneans, had inserted itself in and taken the place of de facto nobility instead of these who were properly the ones who should have had that kind of prestige and that kind of honor. Now, we know, of course, that from God's point of view, God nevertheless used them to accomplish his purposes. But from the point of view of people living at that time, they never would have seen it. So my third point is to say to you that you are, by faith in Christ, seed of Abraham, that you are, by faith in Christ, part of that same nobility. You have been grafted in. You are princes and princesses. You have that privilege. And it isn't necessarily apparent right at the moment. The New Testament teaches that we are sort of nobility incognito. Our life is hid with Christ in God. But when Christ, who is our life, will appear, we will be revealed. We will be like him. John says, look at the love that God has conferred on us, that we should be called children of God. It does not yet appear what we shall be. Well, when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You are already nobility. It's just hidden at the moment. But sort of like the king who goes down, dresses up like a pauper, like a beggar, and mingles among the common folk, unrecognized, still has a certain bearing. You could almost figure it out looking at that guy, that he's not quite like normal beggars. He's not groveling over the next, piece of bread. He's not fighting over the next shekel that comes along. Something about him seems to be just rising a little bit above the petty concerns that most people have in that station of life. You almost get the feeling that he is about something else, and that something is hidden in him that just sort of shines through that beggar's clothing. That's us. We're nobility. We don't need to be all tangled up in the petty concerns of this world. We are royalty. And thus we can detach ourselves from the things that occupy the minds of ordinary folks out there to be generous, to be self-sacrificing, because we know that our life is hid with Christ in God. That's where our treasure is. That's where our hope is. That's where our wealth is. And it is not a place where thieves can break through and steal. It is a place that is secure in him, and thus we can afford to be a little bit detached from all the petty concerns of this world so we can be true Christians.